Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Today we're talking to our guest, Krista Thomason, about the good that comes from bad feelings. Imagine meeting someone who only expressed positive emotions, someone who was always upbeat and excited, who was unfailingly generous, understanding, loving, and optimistic, someone who never complained or criticized, who never found fault or got frustrated. We would think there was something odd about them, right? Something suspect. Wouldn't we wonder what their real thoughts were, what they were thinking behind the scenes and what they disapproved of? What did they hate? Who did they judge? What contempt did they hide in their hearts? And if they never gave any of that away, if we never saw behind their positive veneer, wouldn't we wonder how long they could manage this artificial posture without breaking? How long it would take before they snapped? There's something unnatural about being happy-go-lucky all of the time, something inhuman. No one can be credibly positive all the time because reality won't let them. Life is sad, frustrating, and infuriating. It brings pain and fear. Of course, that's not all it brings. Life delivers beauty and goodness too. But no attempt to excise the negative from our daily lives would actually work. Part of what makes us human beings is that we react emotionally to all of it. Emotions are complicated things. We can influence them, but only to a point. They reveal our innermost thoughts, but are unreliable narrators. They are supposed to communicate our feelings to others, but are easily misunderstood. They're unpredictable and hard to control. This is why we would react so strongly to the person who pretends to be nothing but positive. Surely we'd think something bad has to slip through. No one is in such perfect command of their emotions while life lands blow after blow. The problem is that emotions pop into our brain unreflectively. We have to feel them before we react to them. We might be able to minimize our anxiety, for example, or redirect our curiosity, but that doesn't change the fact that that same anxiety and curiosity were there in the first place. Emotions are in some sense automatic, so the person who expresses only positive emotions would have to feel only positive emotions. That's just not believable. While they are spontaneous, emotions are also responsive to our histories. The things that we love or hate develop during our childhood and build as we get older. We're mistrustful of people because we've been lied to in the past. Certain music makes us sad because we lost the people with whom we used to listen to it. The person who claims to only feel positive things has to have had only good experiences. No one can claim that. Emotions come from our biography, but they also spark by our imagination. We can make ourselves sad on command or persuade ourselves that someone we trust is lying to us, but this control only goes so far. We can rarely talk ourselves out of being afraid or being attracted to someone. Sometimes changing how one feels requires years of therapy and medication. Our emotions are stronger than us. So, emotions are automatic and spontaneous, but easy to trigger and hard to manage. They're products of who we are, but also shape our identity. Imagining an emotion is the same as feeling one, and feeling one is inescapable. We cannot just make ourselves feel only those things we want to. So with all of this in mind, it seems odd that so many people have told us for so long that the key to being a good person is feeling the proper emotion at the right time. But that's exactly what philosophers have done, or so today's guest will argue. As we shall discuss, Buddhists saw controlling emotions as being the key to enlightenment. Aristotle saw the right emotions as leading to a virtuous life. From Confucius to Gandhi, philosophers have tried to get people to overcome those emotions that were deemed harmful. And the rest of us have been failing at it ever since. On today's show, we're going to reject that approach and ask about the value of negative emotions. We're going to look at feelings like jealousy, contempt, anger, and envy, and ask what it is they offer us that should be welcomed. Before we do that, though, I think it's important to underscore the inevitability of negative emotions, to revisit that always positive person and recognize just what an anomaly they would be. Always being happy isn't a sign of perfection, because it means that the person at hand is missing some of the most important aspects of life. A whole person experiences all of what life has to offer, good and bad. For better or worse, to be a human being is to feel, and that can only be controlled so much. And now our guest, Krista Thomason, is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Swarthmore College. She's the author of two books, Naked, The Dark Side of Shame and Moral Life, and most recently, Dancing with the Devil, Why Bad Feelings Make Life Good. Krista, welcome to Why.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
To our listeners, if you'd like to participate, please share your favorite moments from the show and tag us on social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show. Rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform so that others can find the show and listen to all 17 seasons worth of episodes for free, as well as our sister show, Philosophical Currents, at our website, whyradioshow.org. And as always, the show can only happen with your support. We exist solely on listener contributions. So click donate in the upper right-hand corner of our website to make your tax-deductible donation through the University of North Dakota Alumni Foundation portal. So, Krista, I guess I want to start by asking you if I've overstated the problem. How much control do we have over our emotions?
No, I don't think you've overstated the problem. And I think that is something that that philosophers haven't reckoned particularly well with in the history of philosophy. I think there's, and this is an understandable move. I think there's a worry that we don't want to treat emotions as something like irrational forces that just crash over us like waves. And so the response to that has been, well, you know what? Well, they're not those things. These are things that are responsive to reasons. We can influence them. We can direct them. We can have better habits around them. They're not these kind of like crazy irrational things. And at the same time, you know, I agree, they're not these crazy irrational things. But I think in some ways, we've swung the pendulum a little bit too far the other direction. And we've attributed to our emotions, I think, more control than we actually have over them.
Already, you've said some stuff that I think runs counter to the general perception and is a little surprising, including this thing that emotions aren't irrational. Isn't there a great divide between reason and emotion? And hasn't that divide has divided men from women and divided humans from animals? I mean, hasn't there been this notion that in some sense, the twain shall never meet?
You know, that's a really popular view. I actually think that it's not a view that you find literally everywhere, and it's not a view that you find sort of throughout the history of philosophy. It really gains a lot of steam with sort of the Romantic movement in the 19th century, where you have this kind of like deep sense that feelings are like a whole other way of kind of viewing the world or encountering the world. And those things, the conflict between reason and emotion kind of comes out, I think, from our contemporary point of view, particularly in the US. I think we sort of are like deeply influenced by the Romantic movement in that way, because we do tend to think like, oh, you know, my head says one thing and my heart says another. But there's been a long-standing conversation in the history of philosophy about just what is the relationship between reason and emotion. And there are plenty of philosophers who think, actually, no, these two things, you know, they work in concert together pretty well. I mean, if you think about it, when we are, you know, when we do feel various emotions, we usually feel them for reasons. So, you know, if my least favorite coworker goes out to the parking lot and slashes my tires, I'm going to be angry about that. And if you ask me why, I can give you all sorts of really good reasons for it. Feelings and reason were, you know, really so opposed, it seems like we wouldn't be able to explain our feelings in the way that we do.
So what would motivate someone to want to separate reason and emotion? What was going on in the Romantics that they postulated this divide that ran counter to people before them?
Many times when you read the Romantics, they're really criticizing a kind of over-intellectualizing of the way that the world should be. And that's it's sort of reacting a little bit against the Enlightenment. So, you know, the Enlightenment, you know, reason played a really important role in a lot of the intellectual movements of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment folks were people who thought, look, if we can all just figure out how to be rational, if we can all figure out how to use our reason correctly, that's going to be the thing that sort of like moves society forward. And I think in many ways, the Romantics looked at that and said, well, you know, maybe, but there's also all sorts of ways that kind of clinging to this perfectly rational capacity as the most important thing about human beings, that misses some other important stuff that human beings do, you know, a spirit, a drive for curiosity, a real sense of connection to the world. And most of that stuff is about feeling. So I think the Romantics kind of thought, look, you know, too much emphasis on reason, kind of misses out on this other really important aspect of human life. And so they kind of, you know, took the reins and said, like, well, this is the thing that's really going to be important. This is the thing that's going to push humanity forward, is to actually get in touch with our feelings.
Why did we start to think about emotions again in terms of reason and partnering or building off of or interacting with reason?
I think there was some, to some extent, I think the, like most things, every generation that comes after the one before, you know, has some not so nice criticisms about the things that their forefathers did.
Right.
And I think there was a sense that the Romantics kind of traded in reasoning for like a kind of overwrought form of sentimentalism. So, you know, I think people are a little bit, I think they're a little bit suspicious of anything that seems like overly sentimental. You know, we have a lot of, we'll call things like sappy or schmaltzy or that sort of thing. And it's, you know, all this is, it's a kind of criticism about a kind of overwrought emotional response. And so I think there's a perception that the Romantics have kind of, you know, they were being overly dramatic with their feelings and their sort of sense of, you know, emotion being so important. And I think some of it kind of like swung back in the other direction. And then there was the sort of rise of, I think, a more sort of scientific value on scientific perspectives that sort of pushed about against the Romantics, that kind of led, I think, back in the other direction.
That too feels surprising, because science is supposed to be factual and objective and
right. Neutral.
So how does science bring emotions back into the picture?
Oh, well, I think the emphasis is on kind of the objective, at least from a, you know, from a kind of popular perspective. I think science is kind of looked at as, oh, it's objective, and you know, that's the thing that we care about. So if you think that scientific thinking is, you know, kind of thinking par excellence, then you're going to say, well, emotionally laden thinking isn't so good. And so you're going to say, look, you know, we need to divorce emotions from, you know, the kind of thinking that we're supposed to do when we're in our kind of cool moments, because that type of thinking is going to be the better type of thinking.
What attracted you to studying the philosophy of emotions? Why were you pulled into that as opposed to, again, the sort of more typical discussion of argument and analysis of reason? What do you find attractive about studying the philosophy of emotions?
Yeah, there's really sort of two things that drew me to this field. One is a kind of just a really clear commitment that I have to thinking that philosophy is doing its best work when it's helping us figure out how to live better. And when I sort of started to encounter philosophy of emotion in graduate school, I remember thinking, oh, this feels like it's really connected to people's real concerns. This is I know what anger is. Like, I know what contempt is. That's a real human experience that I have. And it's not sort of, you know, abstract or up in the clouds, which is not to say I loved all that stuff about philosophy. I loved all the weird stuff too, and the abstract stuff too. But when it came down to what am I going to spend my time writing about, I wanted to write about things that were connected to real human life. That, and I've spent the majority of my life being told that I need to fix my feelings. I'm always, you know, I feel too much, I feel too little, I feel the wrong things at the wrong time. And I've spent most of my life having people tell me that, you know, it's not okay. It's never okay for you to be angry, and it's never okay for you to be jealous. Those things are always bad. When I encountered work on negative emotions in grad school, I was like, wait a minute. This here's a group of people who's telling me maybe my feelings do have something to say, actually. The thing that I've kind of felt my whole life and felt like people wouldn't listen to me when I talked about them. So it was really for both of those reasons.
How much, when someone says you're feeling too much, how much of that is a code for you're out of control? You can't, you know, you don't control yourself enough. You have frayed ends. Pull yourself together. How much is the anti-emotion language code for letting yourself go?
I think that's often the case. I think it is. It's really frequent. We're actually very bad at dealing with people's strong emotions. I remember really clearly watching Ronald Reagan's funeral, and Nancy Reagan was up at the casket, kind of, you know, having a moment and sort of paying her respects. She was there with her son, and she was kind of like gently patting the casket, and you could tell she was, you know, thinking about a lot of things. And I remember the commentators on the broadcast saying, oh, it's so great that she's being so stoic. It's so great that she's, you know, that she's so controlled and she's really pulling herself together. And I thought to myself, but why should she have to? You know, her beloved husband is dead. And it was kind of insane to me that I thought, well, wouldn't it be okay if she sort of broke down in this moment? If there's ever a moment when it's okay for you to break down, why wouldn't it be okay for you to break down at the death of your spouse? It seems like that's the perfect time for you to break down. And yet people were so praiseworthy of how stoic she was. And I just remember thinking, wow, if we're not okay with, you know, really strong emotion in a case of grief, when are we okay with strong emotions?
That's interesting because, of course, the places where we are allowed to express emotions are sports events and
right.
concerts and things like that. These mm-hmm. are collective experiences. Mm-hmm. You're not an individual anymore. Does our emotional life make us more individual, or does it make us more like other people because everyone experiences anger, everyone experiences curiosity? How much Hebert's separation is there between an individual's emotions and the collective?
I think there is a way that in the beginning, when you were talking about the way we might be suspicious of somebody who always feels positive, I think that's right. And I think one of the reasons we are that way is because our emotions are in many ways the same. We recognize when people are upset. We can see when they're angry. We can see when they're sad. And we also we're pretty good at seeing a situation and thinking, oh yeah, that person is upset in this situation. I also would be upset in this situation. So I think our emotions are actually a thing that is really widely shared among human beings. And it's an experience we were able to kind of communicate really clearly. You know, it doesn't take much when other people are crying and, you know, having a really emotional moment for other people to get emotional too. That said, I do want to leave room for the idea that, you know, people's emotional experiences are in some ways, you know, they can be complex, and, you know, you may react to a situation with one kind of emotional response and somebody else might react very differently to that kind of situation with a very different kind of emotional response. And I don't think we can always predict which way we're going to react given the situation.
Is empathy an emotion, or is empathy something we use to read other people's emotions?
Yeah, that's a good question. Philosophers are divided on this, and I tend to think of empathy more in the way that your kind of 18th century sort of sentimentalists did, like David Hume and Francis Hutcheson and Adam Smith. I tend to think of that more as like a capacity, right? It's an ability that we have to share people's emotions and to be able to anticipate what people might feel or what we might feel in different situations. So I think of it less as an its own discrete emotional experience, but more an ability or capacity we have to communicate our emotions.
Do you think empathy helps us understand our emotions better? I have in my head, I have the image of the person who is completely unempathetic, but who themselves is very stoic, that I don't have a super emotional person who doesn't feel for other people. The lack of empathy comes with a kind of roboticness, a kind of, again, stoicism.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's interesting because I think there's a kind of common assumption that if you are empathetic, you will co-feel with people, right? So if I can understand what someone else is feeling, then I will be in some ways kind of sympathetic or compassionate to their emotional response. But if you think of empathy as a kind of just a capacity to be able to know or anticipate or sense what other people are feeling, you know, a really good bully actually could also be empathetic because they would be able to sort of anticipate or know or see when you're upset. They'd be able to sense your vulnerability, but it wouldn't necessarily lead them to automatically behave in such a way that they're compassionate towards you. So I think you can, I think there are ways that these things can come apart. I don't necessarily think that the stoic person who doesn't quite understand people's feelings is necessarily an insensitive person. And I don't necessarily think that just because you have empathy, you're able to, you will then co-feel with people or be compassionate with them. For example, you may end up, you may actually can, you can use your empathy in ways that are actually kind of nefarious.
I like this idea of compassion and co-feeling. Talk a little bit more about that. What does it mean to co-feel with someone?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, and I think I'm still kind of working out my views about it. But I think that there is, I think we have a tendency to think that in order for you to really be, to have the right kind of reaction to somebody else's emotional response, you either have to feel sort of something similar to them, or you have to be able to kind of like imagine yourself in the same sort of position. And I'm starting to think that, I don't know that that's true, but I do think that there is something about being sensitive to other people's emotional responses that may not actually necessarily require you to kind of imagine yourself in their shoes or to even feel the same sorts of things that they're feeling. But I do think it sort of requires that you're able to work yourself into a kind of shared perspective, you know? Like you can sort of say, it's a little bit, it may be a little bit hokey, but it's the sort of like there but for the grace of God go I, right? You have to be able to kind of imagine, you know, this is a person who's existing in this difficult situation. And, you know, I understand that this is the kind of thing that human beings go through and sort of like we're all together in this. So I do think there's something about being sensitive to other people's feelings that does require you to develop something like what I'm going to call a kind of like ability to share perspectives.
When we come back, we're going to dive into your book and start talking about the various different saints you discuss. And we'll begin with this notion that there are good and bad emotions. But before that, you're listening to Krista Thomason and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
Back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Krista Thomason about bad emotions and the good that can come from them and the negative attitudes about bad emotions. So I guess, Krista, I want to start the second part of our discussion by just asking, what's the difference between a good and a bad emotion?
Your standard view, if you said to somebody, hey, what do you think is a bad feeling? I think they would start naming things like jealousy or hatred or envy or maybe anger. And you could say, oh, well, these are all emotions that, you know, lead to bad consequences. These are emotions that lead us to develop character flaws. These are emotions that might make us hurt people, or they're emotions that sort of bring us down, you know, make us worse, make us feel bad. And I am going to say there is no real such thing as a bad feeling. I think our whole suite of emotional lives, they're all valuable. And what matters more is kind of what we do with them and how we respond to them. But feelings all by themselves, I'm going to say, are neither good nor bad.
How is it that something that makes us feel bad isn't itself bad?
Right. And so this is grief is actually my favorite example of this. So I think grief, for those of us who have experienced it, I think we would say grief feels really bad. It can do a lot of damage to us. It can make us It can really, really bring us down. It can even cause us to engage in various kinds of self-destructive behavior if we're not careful. It feels really bad. But I think if you offered somebody, if you said, hey, would you like to never feel grief again for your loved one? I actually do think people might pause and say, well, I'm not so sure about that. And so I think underneath that pause is the recognition that this bad feeling that I'm going through is actually a manifestation of the love that I had for that person. So what it means to love another person is to feel grief when you lose them. And so if you put it that way, I don't think people would trade the love that they had for somebody else just so they would not have this bad feeling. So if you think about it that way, then you think, well, actually all these negative emotions, even the ones that make us feel bad, they're doing something valuable in our lives.
So grief isn't just a feeling in and of itself. It's about something. You talk about aboutness of emotions. What is aboutness and why is it so important to understand how feelings work?
Yeah, so this is the way that philosophers will sort of point out that, you know, your feelings aren't these kind of totally irrational forces, you know. They have objects, as we will call them. So your feelings are about things. If I'm disappointed because the baseball game gets rained out, I'm disappointed about the baseball game. So when we describe the aboutness of emotions, it's if somebody asks you why you're feeling it, it would be the answer you gave for why you feel that thing. And so when we talk about the aboutness of emotions, oftentimes discovering what emotions are about helps us discover why they're valuable and why they're important.
But that takes a lot of work, right? I mean, sometimes you have to go to therapy, right? why, I mean, this may be a bit far afield, but why is it so hard to know what our emotions are about? Why is it so hard to parse our own feelings?
I think part of the problem is that particularly in this day and age, we actually have extremely little practice doing it. So we are not, I think by and large, encouraged to try to just sit with and actually examine or study or reflect on or think about our feelings, because people, particularly when they're negative, people will immediately rush in and try to get you to do anything to just stop feeling it. And because sometimes our emotional lives are, you know, difficult and complex and it's hard for us to feel these things, I think we jump at the chance to get rid of them also. I think we're actually pretty bad at being uncomfortable and just staying uncomfortable for a while. So I think some of it is actually just down to we don't have the tools to be able to think about this, which is why a lot of people end up going to therapy and trying to get those tools, because that's, you know, partially what therapy does, is to help you figure this out. And so I think partly the philosopher in me says, you know, look, we could actually do this not necessarily having to go to therapy if we actually just spent a bit more time working on and thinking about and being more reflective about our emotions. It may turn out not to be as hard as we think to identify what we're feeling and why.
We're living in a time of numbing of emotions, especially with social networks and the internet, where people mm-hmm. are scrolling infinitely or looking for things to get that dopamine hit, but it's really to not feel other things around them. I myself have tried to step away from reading the news lately. The world is too horrible right now. And I have to step away from social networks because they reveal what's going on in the world. And I find that I'm lacking that ability to numb myself. And that's mm-hmm. that's throwing me off. I want to think about nothing. Mm-hmm. Is that bad? Is it bad to shut down the emotions like that? Does it lead to problems down the line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I sometimes come across as kind of harsh on this, because I think on the one hand, I totally understand why sometimes, you know, you just need a break. You know, again, for any of us who've out there who've gone through, you know, difficult periods of grief, sometimes, you know, you will call somebody and you say, look, I just need to talk about something other than the death of my loved one. I can't talk about it anymore. Perfectly understandable. We can't sort of stay in one register all of the time. But on the flip side of that, though, I think sometimes what's motivating us, so not so much staying away from the news, but what's motivating us to get over our bad feelings is just because we're sort of tired of doing the emotional work that comes along with them. You know, they're not always pleasant, and they're hard, and they don't always feel good. And so, you know, you look at that and you go, I don't want to feel bad anymore. And although that's an understandable response, I guess my question is, you know, are we saying that because, you know, you just need a break? Or are you saying that because you're still wrapped up in this kind of fantasy we've created that the happy, healthy person is a person who feels good all the time? And if that's why you think, well, I got to stop feeling this, why? Because, you know, because I'm not supposed to, because a happy, healthy person always feels good. And so I want to be happy and healthy. Therefore, I want to feel good all of the time. So if that's why you're doing it, then that's where I want to say, well, I don't know. I think you should hold on, because I think you should kind of get over this fantasy that life is supposed to be only full of positive emotions, and that a happy, healthy person really does only feel positive things all of the time, because that's just not real.
So there's this deep claim in your answer about human nature, and that there are philosophers who believe that the human in the state of nature is going to be easygoing and generous and social, and that we are the happiest when we are at our most natural state. But but you're arguing that humans by nature are much more complicated than that, that humans by nature have negative experiences and negative emotions, that human nature is involved, and that emotions are representative of that kind of person as opposed to this artificial one. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And that is, even outside of philosophy, I think people tend to look at negative emotions and they think, oh, those are flaws. Those are aberrations. Those are sort of all the bad parts of human nature. And if we could just get back to this more sort of idyllic place, or we could just kind of fix ourselves the right kind of way. And there's a whole bunch of answers about, like, why did we develop all these feelings in the first place, right? Somebody like Rousseau is going to say, oh, it's because we live in modern society, and modern society creates in us all these unnatural desires and these unnatural drives. And it's those unnatural desires and drives for honor and fame and fortune. Those things are the things that give us these negative emotions. And if we could just get back to this kind of like simple life outside of, you know, the jockeying for position in modern society, then all those bad feelings would go away. Whatever story you want to tell, you know, people have a billion of them about why these negative emotions arise. And surely there's just ways we could get rid of them. And that our like kind of real true human nature is this kind of beautiful, positive, sympathetic ideal. Real. That's what we really are. Whereas I want to say, No, definitely not. That our negative emotions are just as much a part of what it means to be human as our positive emotions are.
What's a controlled emotional saint, and what lesson are they trying to get us to learn?
Yeah, so I look back in the book in the history of philosophy and kind of try to find, you know, these different positions on emotions. And I think the controlled emotion saints have a pretty good footing in the history of philosophy. You find a lot of them. These are the folks who think, look, our negative emotions are something like fundamentally irrational. They're absolutely harmful. There's nothing good about them. And we would be better off if we didn't feel them. And so you find this with the Stoics, of course, are kind of classically in this territory. But I think also somebody like Gandhi is definitely in this territory. Somebody like Spinoza is definitely in this territory. And they think, look, the important thing that we need to learn is to learn self-control. And that is what's going to help us get rid of these negative emotions, hopefully altogether, and never feel them again. We would just be better off if we could root them out completely. As much as I disagree with the controlled emotion saints, I do understand where they're coming from. They look at something like emotion as a threat to your self-composure. And ultimately, something that's a threat to your self-composure is a threat to your freedom. So we don't want to be taken over by these irrational emotions. We don't want to have them like possess us like demons, because ultimately that means we're not really acting freely in the world if that thing is controlling us. And so we need to get these emotions out, because they're going to, if we're not careful, they're going to take control.
I wonder if you'd talk for a minute about the Stoics, because I think a lot of our listeners will have heard their names and have a vague sense of who they are, but not have read them and not have a sense in particular of how their view on emotions are representative of their view about the universe. So could you just spend a couple minutes and explain why the Stoic philosophy of emotion is built on the Stoic metaphysic?
The Stoics, and I should say, are, you know, they're a diverse group, and they don't all agree with each other. But if you sort of try to kind of distill them down into sort of like a nutshell view, and I think this is the thing that people quite don't quite get about the Stoics, because they're having a real moment, you know, these days. There's a lot of like neo-Stoic advice out there in the form of kind of contemporary books. Stoicism is super popular among like high-powered CEOs and that kind of thing, precisely because they preach this kind of mantra of self-control. But what I think people don't often realize is that their notion of self-control is kind of deeply tied to their views about the rest of the universe. So the Stoics, for example, don't believe in free will. They don't think people have free will. They think that, you know, the universe has a kind of like rational order to it that's logically determined by a deity of some kind, right? God, however they describe God. And so human beings are sort of part of that rational order in the same way that kind of everything else is. And our job as human beings on the earth is to sort of like understand what that rational order is and kind of act in accord with it as much as we can sort of act in accord with anything. So the problem is for the Stoics, the only thing that's kind of really important, right, is kind of understanding that rational order. And when you do, that's what's going to make you a good person. On the Stoics view, right? So you're going to be, that's how you're going to be a virtuous person. And so given that, the only thing that's really important for the Stoics is that. That's the thing that's your, that all human beings are supposed to pursue, this particular vision of virtue that they have. And nothing else in human life has any kind of importance. And for them, that means everything, right? So your pursuits, the favorite books you have, everything down to your loved ones, none of those things are sort of really important at the end of the day. Those things are all just kind of like events in the world. They just happen. You have no control over them, and they're not really important. And so that's where they kind of get this idea that self-control is to make sure that you're understanding exactly what kinds of things are important and what kinds of things are not important. Virtue is the only thing that's really important, and anything that kind of disrupts that is not important. And so your emotional life is going to disrupt, according to the Stoics. The reason you feel these negative emotions is because you see things as important that really aren't important. So if I get upset that the baseball game is rained out, the Stoics are going to tell me, look, you're just thinking that baseball games matter. Baseball games don't matter. The only thing that matters is virtue. And so don't get upset about the baseball game because it's not really important at the end of the day.
It reminds me a little bit of the people who, in response to tragedy, will say, it was God's plan.
Yes.
Don't grieve because God had a purpose for your child. Mm-hmm. Or we can't understand what this is, but this was all for good. They're trying to convince you that your emotional perception of the world is wrong and you have to change your mind.
Exactly.
Can you change your mind to change your emotion? Can you decide that your anger is wrong and make it laughter instead?
I don't know how much you can do that. So the Stoics definitely thought that was true. And on the one hand, you know, you want to maintain the idea, at least I do, you want to maintain the idea that we do feel things for reasons and that my emotions can be responsive to reasons, right? So if I pull back my shower curtain and I scream because I think there's a snake in my bathtub, but then it turns out it was just a garden hose or something that was accidentally left in there. Well, the minute that I realize that, you might think, okay, my fear is going to slow down. It's going to abate. It's going to go away. I'm going to, you know, it might take me a little bit to calm down, but I'm going to go, oh, right. Okay. So there wasn't a snake, as it turns out. So I think the Stoics and Gandhi will look at kind of cases like that and say, that's right. Our whole emotional life can function exactly that way, because all we have to do is just kind of like make sure we're having these true beliefs about the world. And if you have true beliefs about the world, then your negative emotions will go away. But I think they mistakenly sort of take that, those sort of more limited cases where like, right, yeah, there are plenty of times where emotions are kind of responsive to the world, but just because they are sometimes, it doesn't mean they are all the time. And I think what the Stoics are kind of asking is a much, much bigger kind of revision than just okay, the snake turned out not to be a snake after all. They really want human beings to kind of radically, radically revise their understanding of themselves, their understanding of the world, their understanding of their relationships with each other. And that I'm not so sure you can maintain. And I think it's telling that most of the Stoic writings are kind of constant advice and counseling about how to do that. So every Stoic that you read, they talk exactly about this, and they sort of like spend all this time trying to show, you know, give you examples and give you cases and give you ways that you can revise your emotional life. And I think there's something telling about that, that the Stoics had to spend every writing they ever did had to be couched as a kind of form of therapy, because I think they might realize just how difficult that project is that they're trying to get people to undertake.
You said something in passing about truth and falsity that makes me wonder whether or not emotions are true or not. If I talk about truth and falsity with students, I'll talk about propositions, right? A proposition right. is a statement that can be either true or false. The snow mm-hmm. is white or the snow is mm-hmm. not white. But eek is right. not a proposition. It's not true or false. Is anger true or false? Is curiosity true or false?
So I don't know if I want to say they're true or false per se, but I do think emotions are about how we experience the world. And we can experience the world sort of closer and farther away from the way the world actually is, right? So let's suppose there is a snake in my bathtub, and let's suppose it's actually a venomous snake. I suppose I live in Australia where I am told there's lots of venomous snakes all over the place. You might think, well, one of the things my fear is picking up on is that I'm in the presence of something really dangerous that might hurt me. So in this particular case, that's true. You are in the presence of something that is dangerous and can hurt you. So in that sense, our emotions do have this kind of epistemic quality where they can reveal things to us about the world, right? My fear is kind of telling me in that particular case, look, I'm in danger. And in fact, I am. So in that sense, I would say because they're sort of about how we experience the world, and our experiences of the world can be more or less reflective of how the world really is. You know, in a case like that, I would say, well, yeah, my fear is, in some sense, it is true.
What about detachment? There's now this huge movement to be mindful, to right. be us in the world, but sort of a little detached. Mm-hmm. And especially folks who are depressed are mm-hmm. encouraged to meditate. And there's this, and you call it a mindfulness mania going yes. on right now. What does mindfulness have to contribute, and what's the problem?
Right. So funny enough, the mindfulness, you know, it's really drawn from the Indic tradition, right? The Indic philosophical tradition, folks like Gandhi, but also the Zen sort of Buddhist tradition. And funny enough, you know, like the Stoics, meditation and mindfulness is rooted in certain kinds of metaphysical views, right, about the world that are part of those philosophical systems. But I think, you know, in our kind of contemporary sort of consumer culture, we're happy to kind of piecemeal stuff, you know, and so we're happy to talk about mindfulness and kind of like separate it out from those big philosophical commitments of these different traditions. So, you know, it depends a lot to me. It depends a lot on what we're talking about when we're talking about mindfulness. So like, what's the motivation for us undertaking mindfulness? Is it because we're sort of just like learning how to deal with stress better? Okay, that's fine. I mean, everybody wants to deal with stress, you know, in a good way. Okay, that's, you know, no problems there. But sometimes mindfulness starts to edge over into kind of Stoic territory where sort of the point of mindfulness is to try to get you to practice caring less about the things that are in your life. And that's the part where I start to, you know, my negative emotions kind of radar starts to get tipped off, because I start to think, well, but wait a second, why is it that we are kind of interested in having this attitude of detachment? Why are we interested in having this attitude where we care less about things and we see them as, you know, not really affecting us? And I think, unfortunately, the answer to that is often, well, because I want to avoid feeling bad. then that's the part where I go, well, okay, but that's not a goal you should have, is to just avoid feeling bad. But I think the vast majority of kind of contemporary mindfulness practices are really about that. It's, you know, people get stressed out about stuff and they don't want to feel bad. And so they turn to mindfulness as a way to avoid feeling bad.
There's this emotional double standard going on that we are encouraged to feel good as much as possible, and we are discouraged from feeling bad as much as possible. And it feels like that's an impossible task, that you can't parse emotions that way.
That's exactly right. And it is, what's funny about that is there's negative emotions and positive emotions all belong in the same club. They're all emotions. And so what's funny to me is that there's all this kind of like praise for wonderful positive emotions. But then when you turn to the negative ones, people will start making all these claims about them. They'll say, oh, you know, they eat you up from the inside. Anger will turn you into an angry person. They'll take you over and sort of possess you, and you'll be in this like berserker rage. And, you know, then you'll wake up, you know, and not have any idea where you are. They have all these like magical properties. But then you turn to positive emotions, and it seems like we don't talk about positive emotions in the same way, right? So like, for example, no one ever tells you that you need to manage your feelings of joy, but they'll tell you that you need to manage your feelings of anger. Well, joy and anger are both emotions. They have the same kinds of qualities, and yet somehow anger is often treated like a loaded weapon, whereas joy is never treated that way. So there's, to me, this is like a kind of impossible double standard that we're setting up for, especially for negative emotions.
So tell me what good anger brings us. What's the case for feeling anger?
So I think the case for feeling anger is what is anger doing? So I think normally when we get angry because oftentimes it's because people mistreat us, right? So that's like kind of a classic case of anger. What is it that anger is telling us then? So I'm going to say, well, what anger is telling you is that you care about yourself. You matter to you. And I think we're sometimes suspicious of the idea that we ought to care about ourselves, because there's a kind of threat always of being self-indulgent or narcissistic or an egotist or something like that. But I actually think, you know, a healthy kind of caring about yourself is completely fine. You know, yeah, I don't want you to be self-indulgent. I don't want you to be a narcissist or an egotist. But I do think it's actually important that you care about yourself. I think it's important that your life matters to you, because when your life matters to you, that's, you know, how you develop meaning in your life and how you decide what kind of pursuits are going to be important and how you, you know, to go about your daily activities and think that they're valuable. I think you should matter to you. So when we get angry, I think oftentimes we get angry at people who treat us like we don't matter. So your anger, in my mind, is a kind of expression of your care for yourself, that you say, you know what, I matter, and it's not okay for people to treat me like I don't matter.
Is that enough? The person in the back of my head says, but anger is so dangerous, that anger is so volatile. Is it enough to justify anger to say, I matter?
This is the part where I say, I'm not so sure that anger's bad reputation is as deserved as we think. I think there's a clear sense that, you know, people think that anger is dangerous. So what I want to ask is, I bet you everybody listening to the show has at some point or another been angry with someone they love. And I bet the loved one is still standing. I know for a fact, you know, I adore my husband. I love him more than anything else on the planet, but I've absolutely been angry with him, no doubt. And yet here we are, still happily married after all these years. So if you think, well, gosh, love and anger can actually coexist. You may not feel particularly loving towards your loved one when you're angry at them, but, you know, a loving, committed, healthy relationship has these bouts of anger in it. And if that's true, then it seems to me maybe anger is actually not as scary as we think. I think we tend to, when we think about negative emotions, we often tend to go to the most kind of extreme examples. We sort of think about like, oh, all the times people have like ruined, you know, relationships or themselves or whatever, you know, out of anger. But we don't think of the sort of closer examples that we all have experience with. All of us, right, have been angry at some point with a loved one. And so if you think like, well, wait a minute, but anger is so much a part of our everyday lives, much more so than we think, then who is this kind of phantom that we're imagining when we're talking about just how dangerous anger is? I think we're imagining that anger is a bigger boogeyman than it actually is.
And you also said that anger and love can coexist. Part of what people struggle with is this vision that we can only feel one emotion at the same time. So all we are is anger. We can, right? We can feel more than one emotion at the same time, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Our emotional lives, I don't think we actually, this is a place where I think we don't give ourselves enough credit for the complexity of human psychology. I think people have had really complex emotional experiences that are tinged, you know, with all sorts of things and emotions that are kind of like interconnected and falling on top of each other. And we can feel so torn and we can feel multiple things at the same time. And, you know, my love for my husband when I get angry at him, it definitely does not disappear. It's still there, even when I'm angry. And so I think we are very much convinced that like emotions are like a pair of glasses. And if you're wearing one, you can't be wearing a different one. But I think they don't function that way.
What about the more judgmental emotions, something like contempt? What's the case for feeling contempt?
Yeah, that's great. I think contempt is another one that gets, when we start thinking about it, we think of sort of like the worst possible examples of contempt, the ones that are really, really judgmental. We think, for example, of like racist contempt or sexist contempt, or, you know, the kind of contempt you feel when you feel somebody is like less, you know, less than a person or something like that. And I think what we don't do is think about, once again, our sort of average everyday examples of contempt, right? And so, you know, for those of you who, you know, live in a neighborhood, the chances is that you have, you know, I'm never going to act like my lawn is impeccable all of the time. That's definitely not true. But when I'm taking a walk around my neighborhood and I occasionally see somebody else's lawn, I sort of go, well, gosh, you know, my lawn might look bad, but it doesn't look as bad as that. I'm going to say that is actually it's a mild, mundane version of contempt. Anytime you sort of look at somebody else and go, well, I'm not like that in a way that sort of like makes you look better. I think that that's a kind of mild form of contempt. Now, you might think, well, that's not particularly attractive. And maybe it isn't. But I think you also have to ask yourself, well, look, we're all pretty confused, I think, about who we are and kind of how we're doing, you know, in our lives. Am I succeeding? Am I not succeeding? Am I doing the right thing? Am I not doing the right thing? And I think inevitably you're going to have comparisons are going to be a part of that, because how do you know? How do I know if I'm doing okay? You know, my example always is yoga class, as somebody who's not very good at yoga, but still commits to it. I don't actually know how I'm doing. I don't know how my progress is. And oftentimes what I'll do is kind of like glance around the class and kind of compare myself to other people and go like, well, am I doing this pose better than that person or worse than that person? And I think you have this, everybody has this need to sort of know a little bit where they stand, and comparison is going to be a part of that. And I think if comparison is part of your life in kind of measuring your own progress, you're going to run into these kinds of feelings of contempt. I think where contempt gets to be a problem is when you start forgetting that as much as you're comparing yourself to other people are comparing themselves to you too. So you've got to remember, in this game of comparison, you're on somebody else's judging table as much as you're putting other people on the judging table. So you can't be, you know, too hot on yourself, because you got to remember you're not always going to be at the top of the ladder either.
Part of what we have to distinguish between is feeling the emotions and reacting to the emotions and acting on the emotions, right? Different things. And so there are times when it's appropriate to act on your emotions, and there are times when it's appropriate just to feel them, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think we don't do a good enough job of kind of distinguishing between all those things. And I think, you know, most of the time we are so afraid of letting ourselves feel negative emotions, especially because we think they're automatically going to lead to a certain kind of behavior, or they're automatically going to lead to a certain kind of reaction. And I think part of the problem is that the reason that they often do, right, the reason we, for example, like lash out in anger, we do that frequently. I think one of the reasons we do that frequently is because we do not know how to actually just feel something without reacting and without acting. We don't have a lot of patience for that. We don't have a lot of practice kind of doing that, because that requires having a more reflective attitude towards your emotions. It requires having more of a sense of kind of like friendliness toward them, of being able to identify them and sit with them and just allow them to be in a way that we tend to be pretty bad at. We tend not to do that particularly well.
You wrote in the book that bad feelings cause more trouble when we tyrannize them. What do you mean by that?
No, I think they do. I think we oftentimes think that a bad feeling is the thing that's doing the work if there's sort of bad stuff going on, right? So for example, if you encounter somebody who's an angry person, I think we tend to look at that person and go, well, if they felt less anger, then that would fix them. I think in this case, the multiple feelings, you know, lots of anger in an angry person is actually more of a symptom rather than an illness. There's something else going on below the surface that has made that person into an angry person. Probably something like a shaky sense of self, where anger is constantly there to kind of, the angry person, I think, is angry because they constantly have a need to defend themselves. And so you might think, well, if you have a constant need to defend yourself, maybe it's because you have a shaky sense of self, or you're, you know, very unconfident or something like that. Well, then the problem turns out to be that thing and not actually your feelings. I've known so many people who have gotten themselves in such worse trouble because they refused to admit that they had a feeling that they didn't want to have. And they would spend enormous amounts of time and energy trying to talk themselves out of the feeling, beat themselves up for having the feeling, stamp the feeling down, convince themselves they shouldn't have it. And they ended up making whatever situation they were in much worse. They ended up making themselves psychologically much worse. And I can't help but think, gosh, I think you would have saved yourself so much trouble and so much time and energy if you had just allowed yourself to feel that feeling and recognized that it was there. I think we spend so much of our time is spent kind of beating ourselves up for feeling certain ways. And I think we end up making bad feelings worse by trying to kind of like lord over them. And we would do better if we just kind of like let them have some of the reins.
I think that anyone who's in a long-term relationship will have the experience of knowing that 9 out of 10 times, it's better to walk up to your partner and say, I am angry at you about X, Y, or Z, than sitting there seething for 3 weeks and then the anger develops a life of their own, right? I mean, you know,
absolutely.
I'm angry you didn't do the dishes. Oh, okay. You know, I mean, absolutely. if you're living with someone who's violent or who can't handle that, then that's a different situation. But then the problem isn't the anger, right? The problem
That's
is
exactly right.
the partner.
That's exactly
One last
right.
negative emotion, spite.
Yay,
spite feels really mean. Talk a little bit about spite and the benefit of spite.
Yeah, spite, I have to admit, I have a real soft spot for spite. It's one of my favorites. I will describe spite as an emotion of self-defense. So usually we feel spite when someone tries to lord themselves over us, when someone tries to butt into our business, when someone tries to kind of wag their finger a little bit too much. It's a little bit of emotional rebellion against people who try to kind of stick their nose in our business where it doesn't necessarily belong. And spite is our kind of way, I think, of responding to that. Spite is a feeling that helps us set boundaries. For what people are allowed to do and say and tell us. So I think when people think of spite, they tend to think of the, you know, the kind of spite that causes you to do something nefarious or mean-spirited to people. Oftentimes that's kind of a reaction to spite or an action that we take with spite rather than just recognizing the feeling of spite and letting ourselves feel that. And oftentimes I think we do spiteful things in part to sort of signal to other people that our lives are our own to live. So this is the old adage is don't cut off your nose to spite your face. So one of the things that people will criticize about spite is that oftentimes people will do something wildly imprudent. So my favorite example is, you know, if my mother starts lecturing me about my cholesterol levels and says, you know, you better not order that dessert. There's definitely a part of me that will be like, well, now I'm ordering two desserts, right? And so why do I react that way? Well, I react that way because, you know what? My life is mine to live. And there's more important things, my life being mine to live and me getting to be the one who makes my own decisions is oftentimes more important to us than doing the smart thing. So doing the thing that's authentically mine is sometimes more important than doing the prudent or the wise thing, which is why I think in spite, we typically will do things that are bad for us just to spite other people. Because then you know that reaction, you know, that thing that I just did, that was only for me and no one else and for no other reason. It's a sheer expression of my own self-will.
There seems to be an underlying theme in all of the discussion, in your account of the negative emotions, in your criticism of those people who try to control emotions, and that is that I'm important, that my self matters, that my perspective is worth defending. Am I reading that right?
Yes, that is correct. I think most of the time our negative emotions are there because they're expressions of or manifestations of the concern we have for ourselves.
Talk a little bit more about that.
I think this is actually one of the reasons that people are suspicious of negative emotions. I think the reason they're suspicious is because they're actually a little bit suspicious about the fact that we care about ourselves. I think self-love has taken on, you know, kind of a difficult status. On the one hand, in contemporary sort of parlance, you know, people will talk about self-love and self-care and, you know, all that sort of stuff. That's not really so much, there's that thread, but then there's also, you know, the idea that you always get accused of getting, of being selfish if you think too much about yourself, right? And so I think there's a little bit of suspicion that, like, well, you should love yourself, but not too much. And that if you think of these negative emotions as kind of wrapped up in our sense of selves, which I think they are, then I think that's one of the reasons that people will get suspicious of them. Because it's like, oh, well, that's just about self-love. But what I want to say is there's absolutely nothing wrong with self-love. And part of it is going back to that really big conversation about, you know, human nature and what human life is supposed to be like. People will sometimes think, well, yeah, but your life doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. You know, in the from the perspective of the universe, none of this stuff is important. To which I want to say, yeah, but you know what? I don't live my life in the grand scheme of things. I live my life in my regular, average, everyday capacity of my regular, boring life. I go to work. I have my loved ones. I have my activities, all my plans and projects. All my value, all that stuff is here in my normal human life. And so it's fine for me to care about that. I don't always constantly have to think about, but in the grand scheme of things, or I don't have to have this perspective of human life at the end of the day being small and not mattering. I think human life does matter, and it matters especially to the humans who live it.
And there's a level of erasure that's not only offensive, but traumatic, because if life doesn't matter, then my daughter doesn't matter. And I can't exist in a universe that my daughter doesn't matter.
Exactly. The ask, right, is that you're supposed to see all the things in your life as only mattering so much. But when we're in the thick of it and we're thinking about, you know, our loved ones and we're thinking about the things that give our lives meaning, you know, we can't just pretend like that's, you can't live in a way that's detached from that. And being attached to your life and being invested in it is going to come along with a liability to all of these different emotions, complex though they may be, negative though they may be. It's part of what it means to think my life matters.
So as we wrap up, I guess I want to ask, is there anything else that you think we should know? What's the fundamental message that you want people to take away from this conversation?
I think the fundamental message I want people to take away is feel all of your feelings. You can feel them. It's okay. Next time you have a negative emotion, I want you to say, gosh, I'm feeling envy right now. And then just stop and let yourself feel it.
The book is called Dancing with the Devil, Why Bad Feelings Make Life Good. It's written for general audiences, so it's very easy to understand, but it's super rich and takes an interesting dive into the history of philosophy and also detailed exploration of all of the emotions we talked about and some we haven't. So, Krista, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have been listening to Krista Thomason and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'll be back with a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
We're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Krista Thomason about negative emotions and her book, Dancing with the Devil, Why Bad Feelings Make Life Good. There are so many negative emotions that we feel regularly during the day that they scare us. But we shouldn't necessarily be scared about how we feel them. We have to attend to how we react to them. But feeling them is not necessarily bad. We need to feel all of our feelings because that's psychologically healthy, because we are reacting to the world around us, because we are interpreting and judging and evaluating and trying to figure out our place in the world. Emotions have purpose. They set boundaries. They help us judge ourselves. They explain to us what we're striving for. Imagine not having any emotions. Imagine not having any wants or desires. How would you move forward in the world? How would you know what to pursue? How would you know what's important to you? Who is important to you? How to care about your family or your loved ones, and how to do your job, and how to enjoy a movie? You couldn't do any of these things without emotions, and the negative emotions are as urgent and as important as the positive one. Again, feeling is not the same thing as reacting, and we can exist in anger, or we can have spite or contempt, and still treat people well, and still treat people with respect. At the core of the entire discussion is a reassertion that we matter as individuals, that the self-love that we feel is relevant to our place in the universe, that we shouldn't try to erase ourselves, that we shouldn't try to subordinate ourselves. Yes, we shouldn't be narcissistic. Yes, we shouldn't be too arrogant. Yes, we shouldn't place ourselves in front of other people who are more needy than us. There are lots of questions of ethics and justice that come from the assertion of self-love. But that self-love is still healthy, and that self-love is still important because it tells us who we are and that we matter to ourselves and to people around us. Feelings underscore that. Feelings help us identify who we are and who matter to us. And if we don't feel feelings, we aren't living life the way that we should. With all of that said, if you've been listening to this episode on Sunday evening on Prairie Public, please know that a longer version with almost 30 more minutes of discussion is available online and as a podcast. Visit Why Radio Show, whyradioshow.org, to listen or subscribe for free. For everyone else, rate us on iTunes and Spotify to help spread the word about the show. Follow us on all the usual social networks. Our handle is always at Why Radio Show, again, WHY Radio Show. And please help us continue broadcasting by making your tax-deductible donation at whyradioshow.org. Click donate in the upper right-hand corner to go to UND Alumni's donation portal. We exist solely on the money you provide. Thank you yet again to Krista Thomason, the folks at Prairie Public, especially our engineer, Tay Calloway. I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, signing off for Why Radio. Thanks for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.